This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Cassie Huff, and today the mutton indicator hits record levels. We're going to look at what is driving this sheep market higher.
We've seen extremely strong demand from global markets, which has driven over the hooks prices higher, particularly from China, which has continued to absorb a lot of Australian mutton through the first quarter of the year.
And supermarket giants Coles and Woolworths are facing pressure to boycott suppliers linked to the exploitation of migrant workers. We're going to take a look at how that might work and what's actually being proposed in the next half hour. So do stick around. It's coming up to 6 minutes past 12. But first up today, the Rankins on the twin station near Coober-Pedy welcomed the news that the $25 million required to rebuild the dog fence has been committed. Yesterday, if you're listening to the Country Hour, you would have heard that the federal and state governments, as well as the sheep industry, pledged to provide money to replace more than 1,600 kilometres of dog fence. Obviously, we would have to wait to hear from the Labor government if it does form the federal government after the election. But in the meantime, the Twins station pastor, Petey Rankin, says that with the dog fence running through their property, this is excellent news.
Oh, look, for us, that's excellent. I mean, we have the dog fence running on our property. It's one of our boundary fences, so it's excellent news because it certainly, when you drive along it, there's numerous holes that have been patched up, whether it be patched up by us or somebody else, and they don't always stand the test of time. So certainly knowing that there'll be some money put into it, it's probably one of those things that does slightly get forgotten, probably because of its location, but also it's just no one really probably complains about the dog fence. It just is there, it's there, it does its job. So to know that, yeah, some money will be spent on it is excellent news.
One of the reasons behind this would be that some people would argue is that the parts of the dog fence aren't doing their job anymore because it's 100 years old and somewhat decrepit in some places. Are there areas in that district that you're aware of that probably really do need to be replaced altogether?
Yeah, look, for us, we have lots of patches that do need fixing up, but they have been not replaced, but there's been patch jobs done on them. Look, they're probably never going to last lengthy amounts of time, the patch jobs that have been done. So having them replaced is great news because it certainly is probably overdue to be done. But we don't have huge dog issues, and that's due to also the drought, obviously. But we're quite lucky being on the inside of it. We don't get at the northern end of our property, we certainly see dogs, but not a hell of a lot. So, look, for us, it's certainly something that needs to be done, but it's not really something that we've ever thought about going, oh, you know, that all needs to be fixed up, because probably like most people, you go along, you see a spot and you just patch it up anyway.
Now, while you haven't recently had big problems with dogs, have you had many problems in the past?
Yeah, we have. Yes, we certainly have had, you know, you'll see quite a gaping big hole in it where you'll get quite a few have come through, and whether you get, you know, the mum and she comes in and has a litter. We, up that northern end of our property, which is where the dog fence is for us, we often, as I say, not lately, but years ago when the conditions were better, you'd go out there and, yeah, it was nothing to see five or six dogs in a pack together, and then you'd go out and when the season was right, you'd go out and you'd see puppies or you'd see their dens. So, yeah, look, we certainly have had issues with them prior to this drought. Yeah, definitely.
So, Mr. Rankin, if the dog fence isn't something that you've thought a great deal about, or although you're happy to hear this announcement, I suppose what are some of the bigger issues facing you at the moment?
Well, I mean, look, don't get me wrong. The dog fence being done is fabulous news, and it really is, because it hasn't been touched, and certainly the patch-up jobs are not going to last forever. So having it done, especially for those that have dog problems, it is amazing news. That really will keep many people happy, and I think that's fantastic to have it done, because then also it means it won't need to be done now for, well, as you say, it's been however many years that it's gone by without being fixed, so it should last another however many years once it's been done. But for us, look, right now we've got a massive kangaroo problem. They're just, as I say, we're overrun with them. This drought is knocking them around. The summer knocked them around. We lost a lot from the heat, and they just don't cope in the heat, and they're not coping without food or water either. But kangaroos are a massive problem for us, and look, obviously, same as the rest of the most of the country, it's the drought. That's our main issue right now.
Yeah, I think just getting some water into this country is one of the biggest issues, as the Twins Station Pass was Petey Rankin said as she was speaking with Lucas Forbes. If you'd like to read more about that announcement on some funding being put towards the dog fence, you can go to abc.net.au/rural. But while we're talking about the state's sheep industry, it seems China's insatiable appetite for Australian meat has pushed mutton prices to a new high. The National Sale Yard Mutton Indicator is now sitting at a record 547 cents a kilogram carcass weight. It's topped the previous record set in May 2017, and it's well above the running five-year average of about 390 cents a kilo for this time of year. Meat and Livestock Australia's Adam Cheatham says prices should remain buoyant, but the weather over the next few weeks will have a large impact on the market.
So on Tuesday, we saw it hit 541 cents per kilogram carcass weight, and it actually increased further on Wednesday. So we're seeing, a relatively strong demand from global markets, which is driving it, and also potential concerns of supply moving through into winter.
So what's it sitting at the moment, Adam?
As of today, it's sitting at 547 cents per kilogram.
547 cents a kilogram. What's been the main driver behind that? Is it people stocking before they expect a winter shortage?
Some of the numbers we've been looking at more recently is the potential for a shortage into winter. It's not set in stone yet, but given the high rates of turnoff that we have seen through the first 6 months of the year, there's perhaps an expectation for lamb supplies and sheep supplies to decline through winter. But also we've seen extremely strong demand from global markets, which has driven over the hooks prices higher, particularly from China, which has continued to absorb a lot of Australian mutton through the first quarter of the year.
What's your expectation then, Adam, that we'll see that figure do, given that there is that shortage, that winter is approaching? Will that average continue to climb?
Yeah, it's a difficult one to predict, to be honest. Given the expected short supply, it's expected that prices will find support. However, how the season tracks over the next few weeks, if we do see that autumn break, there's a number of variables which would play into this, but certainly there's an element of price support for the next few months. Whether they will go any higher is still an unknown. Last year we saw prices obviously peak a little bit later in the season, so if this is the early peak, we might see them come off, but there's an expectation for support in the next few months.
Do you have concerns about sustainability in the longer term of these markets, if there is a shortage of supply and there is this increased demand?
Yeah, I guess that's something that we would be a consideration. I think what we have to put in perspective is we are, one of the largest producers of sheep meat globally in terms of an abundance of supply. What we're seeing at the moment is global demand is really the driving force, which is potentially, driving prices higher. I think, domestically, if we can see an improvement of conditions, there's certainly intentions and there's certainly the requirements from producers there to maintain a relatively stable flock. So I think at the moment that the driving force behind the prices is really the demand that we're seeing for Australian sheep meat.
You touched on it earlier, but just how important will the seasonal conditions that unfold over the next month or so be in affecting these prices?
Yeah, it is pivotal. I mean, for the livestock industry at the moment, we've obviously seen sustained dry conditions across much of the country, to be honest. So really when we're looking at producers and their intentions as we move forward, any good rainfall coming through into late autumn and into winter is going to be pivotal to producer intentions, whether they retain breeding ewes or what they plan to do as we come into the spring season. So certainly the season is always one to watch, and unfortunately it's an uncertainty as well, so it doesn't give us any clarity.
That was Adam Cheatham. He's the Senior Market Analyst with MLA, speaking to Joe Prendergast there. It's coming up to 12:15.
This week on Landline, is it a bird? Is it a chicken? No, it's a quail.
We're going to be processing 5,000 a week. We're going to be, no matter what.
Also, we travel more than 2,000 kilometres visiting outback roadhouses and their unique owners.
My coffin's there. I'm going to die at 100. We'll have a party for 3 days while I burn away.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
Sounds like an interesting program. Those quails that they're talking about, I think they're some of the biggest quails that you'll see in Australia. They are absolute monsters. Do check out Landline on Sunday on ABC TV. But on the program here, we'll stick with what's happening in agriculture at the moment. And it seems the supermarket giants Coles and Woolworths are under a bit of pressure to boycott suppliers linked to the exploitation of migrant workers. We've heard a lot about these stories over the years, but the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility has raised concerns with both supermarkets about the accreditation of labour hire providers in their domestic supply chains. Rhiannon Tuffield has the details.
Shepparton in northern Victoria produces some of the best fruit and vegetables in the country, but it's also an area that spread stories of farm exploitation and underpayment, where foreigners pick and pack for hours under the hot sun for little return. There's been significant efforts from the state government, workers and unions to improve the industry, yet cases of mistreatment continue to be investigated by the Fair Work Ombudsman or trickle through the courts. But the attention has now turned to Australia's supermarket giants.
We've had a number of concerns about Woolworths and Coles with the use of labour hire more generally in their supply chain, and the fact that there seems to be a consistent failure of workers to be paid the correct amount under the law. Also, I mean, Coles and Woolworths have, overall, they're the lead employer in their supply chain. So we say they have oversight over all the workers that are put in place, that, you know, they control much of what happens on farms, you know, right down to what colour elastic band is used on broccolini, for example. So in that case, it's their responsibility to make sure that they're doing the proper due diligence over the workers that are on their farms and sort of picking the tomatoes and picking the other fruit and vegetables and packing them that ultimately end up in the supermarket.
That's ACCR Director Katie Hepworth, who along with the National Union of Workers is forcing Coles and Woolworths to look at how their actions are contributing to the grief of so many workers. Under Woolworths' policies, a labour hire provider must be accredited under three systems: the state licensing system for labour hire, the Australian government's seasonal worker program, or StaffSure. But Ms. Hepworth says that under this current system, a company no longer accredited by some schemes may still be able to provide labour to Woolworths' farms under other schemes.
They've brought in a number of processes to accredit labour hire providers, but we're still seeing companies like AgriLabour being able to provide labour to Woolworths and Coles suppliers, despite the fact that they continually have findings against them in the courts and by the Fair Work Ombudsman. We highlighted that there were huge reputational risks to Coles and Woolworths from having, you know, hugely exploited labour in their supply chain.
Vanuatu national Chulia Rakara was among a group of workers who received $150,000 in compensation after Brisbane-based company AgriLabour was found to be underpaying workers. Ms. Rakara travelled from Vanuatu to Australia in the hope of securing more money for her family, but ended up earning as little as $8 per hour for her work on a tomato farm.
I really felt that I shouldn't have come to Australia, because the same money I was getting from Australia, I was getting here in Vanuatu. Our group, we really want to thank the union because of what the union is doing around Australia
In a statement to the ABC, AgriLabor Managing Director Casey Brown says the campaign was pressuring the supermarkets to adopt union-friendly labour supply chain obligations.
These organisations have been involved in an ongoing campaign to pressure the supermarkets to adopt union-friendly labour supply chain obligations. Ms Rakara's health and safety complaints about working conditions on the farm in question were not found to have been substantiated by WorkSafe Victoria. AgriLabor Australia categorically rejects any allegation that it exploited migrant workers.
Workplace relations lawyer Charles Power was representing several workers who had taken federal court action against AgriLabor. He says he continually sees issues in remote work sites where there's the use of overseas labor and believes the supermarkets do have a responsibility to take more action.
Remote work sites where there's the use of overseas labour, these areas, these margins of the workforce that are the areas where exploitation is rife. And so long as there isn't a proper basis for affected employees to get help and to seek assistance and put pressure on their employers, then there's always going to be a problem.
That was Rhiannon Tuffield with that report looking at the exploitation of migrant workers and what supermarkets can do about it. Do you think it's achievable what is being suggested there? You can text in on 0467 922 783 or call in on 1300 222 891. I mean, yeah, we hear consistently about how hard it is to actually make this, actually follow through on this and know where labour's coming from and actually make it an easy way for producers to ensure that their labour is being handled appropriately. So, I wonder how well the supermarkets would be able to do that. As I said, you can text in on 0467 922 783. And from supermarkets to looking at perhaps bigger picture farms, it seems we've been talking about this quite a bit lately, but tractors and quad bikes do remain the leading causes of injuries on farms. But the deaths caused by both vehicles have actually declined since 2017. That's according to new research from AgriFutures Australia, which shows that fatal accidents caused by tractors fell from 13 to 9 in the 12 months from 2017 to 2018. And the deaths involved in quad bikes fell from 11 to 6. Senior Manager for Business Development with AgriFutures, Jen Medway, explains the findings.
So the report obviously just captures these health and safety kind of outcomes for on a yearly basis. So looking at non-intentional farm deaths and injuries, I have to be honest, the injuries are always underrepresented because obviously I'm a farmer myself and plenty of things have happened on our farm that we haven't reported. So we do know that the injuries are underreported, but certainly the death toll, which is unfortunately really high for agriculture, shows that we're pretty much on par with previous years. Although we do hear a lot about tractor and quad deaths as a leading cause, and it unfortunately continues to be, although those statistics have fallen, which is fantastic to hear. I'm assuming it's very dry down there where you are as well. So one of the big changes this year have been for hay bales and utes have actually their contribution, I guess, to the death toll has unfortunately risen since last year. But certainly we're showing that there are some good signs being made in tractors and quad bike deaths, but certainly more needs to be done.
So, Jen, when we look at who is most at risk when it comes to farm safety, what have your findings revealed?
Unfortunately, it's mostly males. Male people are more at risk, I guess you would say, or more likely to have be killed on farm. And obviously that probably reflects, I guess, the operations that actually happen on farm. So not to say that women aren't at risk either, but certainly we have seen that there are a number, a larger percentage are actually males. really sadly, though, we still do see a number of deaths for children under the age of 15. And that really reflects the fact that our workplace is actually also our home. So unfortunately, we do see a large number of the deaths and attributed to agriculture actually in children under 15 years.
So what are some of the practical measures then that AgriFutures in its National Rural Issues Program and as a lead agency for Rural Safety and Health Alliance is investing in when it comes to improving farm safety?
So there's a couple of different areas. We're sort of refocusing, I guess, our energy in this space. And that comes on the back of the fact that over the last couple of years, the statistics haven't changed, which is really concerning in that there are a lot of dollars flowing into this area. And unfortunately, we aren't seeing the rewards so much so that, we are seeing gains certainly in some areas, particularly around regulations, particularly around quad bikes. There is a strong movement to side-by-side vehicles versus quads. Tractors still remain challenging. So I guess from our point of view, the re-energised focus on the Rural Safety and Health Alliance, which is an alliance of about 10 of the rural research and development corporations, and we're focusing on innovative controls, actually ways that you could implement something, for instance, like a three-point linkage, maybe to make that sort of thing safer or particularly where it's been so dry, to look at how we can continue to innovate to just change some of the safety ways that we're engaging, for instance, in augers. So that's one element. Other elements actually include some practice change. So how can we actually engage and encourage farmers and the sector at large, I guess, to actually make those changes that make our environment safer? So we're at the beginning of this path. So there's certainly some ways to go, but we're just taking a much more innovative and, I guess, really focus on practice change rather than just researching around the issue. And while that's really important and that will continue, we're certainly looking at really innovative, like I said, and practical changes that we can put in place to shift the dial, I guess, in terms of these pretty horrific numbers for ag.
Jen, according to Safe Work Australia data, more than one in five workers who died at work in agriculture. It's got the highest fatality rate of any Australian industry. Now, we're in the midst of a federal election campaign. What would AgriFutures wish list look like for an incoming federal government to address?
Yeah, look, I don't know that there's anything specific at this point in time. I think there's lots of things that can be done from AgriFutures Australia's point of view. For us, we really want that national narrative around and some strategy. So from our perspective, I guess we would love to see, when the national narrative is being discussed for agriculture, that health and safety is right up there as one of the key areas that we could, certainly from a social perspective, in terms of the social cost associated with death and injury in agriculture is quite large, but there's also a really large economic burden, which we think just elevates it to something that really needs to be talked about at the national level. It's often something that we all think of, it's terrible and, nothing's been done, but at the end of the day, if we could start to see it as part of some really strategic discussion, I guess, at the national level, that would really help elevate the issue to, I guess, be discussed in the political realm, I guess.
That was Jen Medway from AgriFutures talking to Liz Reimel there about injuries on farms and what can be done to hopefully continue this downward trend of fatal accidents on farms that is being seen at least in tractors and quad bikes, which is good news given how many times we hear about how dangerous or terrible accidents that have occurred due to those vehicles. So some somewhat good news there, which is good to hear. Before we get to news, though, we're going to look at another issue that deals with people's health in regional areas, and that is Q fever and whether or not people in rural communities are being put off getting the vaccine because of the cost. If you are or if you've put some thought into this, do give us a text on 0467 922 783 or call in on 1300 222 891, because while there's a movement from politicians in looking to further, there's a bit of a movement to get politicians to look at further subsidising the cost, which can be in the order of $300 or $400. A researcher is looking into the severity of Q fever and wants to see this issue addressed immediately. Professor Nat Kiram-Kathesan from the University of New England travels the state and the country, indeed New South Wales and Queensland, raising awareness about the effects of Q fever. And he says it comes as a number of cases in rural New South Wales are increasing.
We are coming into contact more with animals. People are moving into rural settings. And also, it's not only the farm animals, but also the marsupials can carry this disease. So there's increasing numbers and also increasing awareness, and we are able to detect them as well.
What could someone who's been in contact with animals, what would they need to see to realise that they may have the symptoms of Q fever?
That's interesting. In the acute form, it'll just be like a flu, an illness with temperature and so on. But most general practitioners, when they know and get the history of the patient, could recognise that it may be Q fever, and since it is a bacterial infection, it can be treated with antibiotics. However, if it is not treated properly, you can in some cases develop chronic Q fever and also the chronic fatigue syndrome, which is very debilitating. So that's why we are quite keen that people should be aware of this, give a proper history to the GP when they go, and tell them that they have been exposed to animals or even visited farms if they are not living in a rural property, so that proper treatment can be given.
Do we know what kind of numbers of people are vaccinated against it?
We know that people, students who do agriculture degrees or veterinary students, and all veterinarians have to be immunized, including people who work in abattoirs. So that's a prerequisite in Australia. And as I said, this is the only country where we have a vaccine for this illness.
What do you believe needs to happen to try and make sure that, that people are well aware of the risks when you are dealing with animals, and also the need to be vaccinated and to receive that immunisation?
I think all farmers working in Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria should be aware of this. And even, you know, contractors who go for short times to work on the land, because this is the bacteria can be in the soil and be inhaled. People who transport animals or carcasses, they all have to be aware, and possibly the vaccine should be offered to such people.
There's been a fair amount of talk by the politicians about whether the cost needs to be subsidised more. Are you hearing that the cost of the vaccine, which can run into the hundreds of dollars, is something which is turning people off it?
It could, but it is not only the vaccine that costs. The cost involves also testing you before you give the vaccine, and, you know, 2 to 3 GP visits, that's what the vaccine is all about. And this is one of the reasons that the vaccine is not given overseas to people, because it's a costly exercise. But our country can afford it, and I think it should be offered to farmers at a subsidized rate. But I'm not a politician, I'm a scientist.
But you certainly don't want to turn people away from it because of the cost, and that's some of the stories that we hear is people saying, look, it's just something I can't afford, even though the effects of Q fever can be quite severe.
It could be, especially if you have chronic Q fever, it will be forming a big impact on the, you know, health budget of the country, because some people get this chronic Q fever and they need long-term therapy.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. That was Professor Natkiram Kathesan from the University of New England speaking to Tim Fuchs there about the risks associated with Q fever, and something we've been covering here on the Country Hour for a long time and will continue to into the future. We'll head across to the news desk now. We're joined by Samantha Johncher. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, Cassie. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the former Liberal candidate for Lyons, Jessica Whelan, failed to disclose her controversial online comments to the party. Ms. Whelan resigned this morning after a series of anti-Muslim posts in her name emerged. Yesterday, she denied responsibility for one Facebook post, which Mr. Morrison said would be investigated by the federal police. The state government has accused the opposition of obstructing free screenings and police checks for volunteers in South Australia. Minister for Human Services Michelle Lensick says a bill to cut the fee permanently was held up yesterday in Parliament by Labour asking questions. Labour says it intends to vote for the law next week, but ideally wants a change to how it operates. And the leading human rights lawyer, Jeffrey Robertson, has urged the Australian government to do more to help WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Speaking at his first extradition hearing in London, Assange vowed not to consent to being extradited to the US over charges relating to leaking government secrets. Yesterday, the 47-year-old was sentenced to 50 weeks in jail for breaching the Bail Act following his arrest at the Ecuadorian embassy in London last month. There will be more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks so much for that, Samantha. Still to come on the Country Hour, the march of alternative protein sources that look like meat continue. We'll get into that in the next 10 minutes or so, but we'll find out what's happening in weather. We've got Paul Bierman. Hi, Paul.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
What's happening in weather across South Australia?
Yeah, well, we've still got this low pressure system sitting south of the state, and that's been responsible for generating some showers over the past few days. In the past 24 hours, some notable rainfall totals to mention are at Mount Hope, where a further 25 millimetres has fallen. We also had 21 millimetres at Cummins, and even other parts of the state. Moonta's had 14 and Streaky Bay 13. A number of places through the Mount Lofty ranges have also had between 10 and 15 millimetres. But generally, a lot of the other agricultural parts of the state have missed out on a lot of the showers in the last 24 hours. A lot of rainfall totals there in the order of just sort of 1 to 3 millimetres. And since 9 a.m. today, we've seen some further rainfall totals, this stage moving into the southeast, which has missed a lot of the rainfall over the past few days. See, this morning already, Robe has had around 11 millimetres and Cape Jaffa 8, and that system is moving towards Mount Gambier at the moment, so I do expect a few millimetres to fall around Mount Gambier over the next hour or two. Generally today, we are looking at further showers, sort of generally across the agricultural parts of the state, so slight to medium chance across the northern agricultural areas, but increasing to a medium to high chance across the southern agricultural areas. Those showers will continue through much of the day today, but ease right back in the late afternoon and evening to mostly clear by Saturday morning. So by Saturday morning, we then are left with just a slight chance of showers about coastal parts of the state, increasing to a medium chance about the lower southeast coast and also the northern Spencer Gulf coast during Saturday morning. We're also likely to see some areas of fog about for Saturday morning, particularly about Eyre Peninsula and the west coast, but also possible about the mid-north and the Flinders as well. Moving into Sunday, as the airstream turns east-northeasterly, we'll see those showers push away from the state, but just a slight chance of a morning shower about the eastern Eyre Peninsula coast and about other southern coasts of the state during the morning. Otherwise, a dry day with areas of fog and even some frost about the Mount Lofty and Flinders ranges and also about the eastern border districts during Sunday morning. Similar on Monday, a dry day, all that shower activity should have cleared away by then, but just a chance of some morning fog and some morning frost about those eastern and central districts as well. Then Tuesday next week, we do have another cold front moving through it. This stage, it does look like it'll move fairly quickly through the state, moving through the western part during the morning and then clearing the eastern districts by late afternoon, bringing a slight to medium chance of showers across the northern agricultural areas and southern pastoral districts, increasing to a high chance about the southern agricultural areas with some chance for some thunderstorms as well there on Tuesday. Probably see a bit of a lull in the showers during Wednesday before another significant cold front moves through during Thursday next week. That could bring with it further showers and even some thunderstorms and possibly even some small hail to the southern half of the state during Thursday and Friday next week. In terms of rainfall totals up until Tuesday, most of that will be falling either this afternoon and also during the front on Tuesday. We are looking at, for the most part, just 1 to 5 millimetres across the southern agricultural areas, but falls of 5 to 10 millimetres are possible about southern coasts and ranges, but less than 2 millimetres across the southern pastoral districts and the northern agricultural areas. We do have a strong wind warning out at the moment for the central coast, but the winds are generally easing back through the course of today, so we'll be cancelling that warning later this afternoon, and very light winds across the coastal waters during the weekend and generally around the state with that high pressure system coming in over the top of us, but we do expect the winds to be increasing once again with this front early next week. Cassie?
Well, fingers crossed there is a bit more coming through to pick up some of these holes that haven't had that much rain, but I'm glad to hear that there is some on the way for the southeast that was looking like it was missing out a bit on some of the weather that was coming through. So that's good to hear. Thanks for that, Paul.
Thank you.
That was Paul Bierman from the Weather Bureau speaking there. And into the far west of New South Wales, there is a bit of a thunderstorm around possibly tomorrow in the early morning. Otherwise, it'll be a mostly sunny day. There could be some overnight temperatures falling to between 9 and 12 degrees, probably the lower end, and daytime temperatures will reach between 19 and 23 degrees. The lower western will be partly cloudy. Overnight temperatures there will fall to around 10, and the daytime temperatures will reach between 18 to 21 degrees. You're listening to The Country Hour. It is coming up to 21 minutes to 1.
Want to make life even better for young people in your community?
ABC Haywire brought together 50 young people from across the country
to ask how they would make life better for young people from regional Australia.
They came up with 7 inspiring ideas.
Think one of their ideas could make a change in your community?
There's $100,000 in grants up for grabs.
Go to abc.net.au/haywire for more information or to apply for a grant.
Be quick. Closes May 13.
A company called Beyond Meat made its debut on Wall Street overnight, becoming the first alternative meat company to go public on the American Stock Exchange, in what's been described as one of the biggest IPOs since the global financial crisis. Shares in Beyond Meat closed at a whopping $68.75 a pop, which actually values the company at about $3.8 billion US. To get an understanding of just how significant this is for the alternative meat industry, Matt Brand spoke to Matt Ball from the Good Food Institute.
Well, I think Beyond Meat's IPO and its success is extremely significant. And Beyond is really the first company of its kind to go public. It's a new type of food company. And they're making plant-based meat for everyone. They're not just targeting vegetarians. And that the financial markets recognize the potential here, and it really changes the game for all other startups and anyone looking to get into this space.
Were you expecting this company to close on day one at $65 a share?
Oh, no, I was not expecting this at all. And 2 weeks ago, they were thinking that their IPO price might be between $19 and $21. And they were only going to offer fewer shares. And then they increased the number of shares they're offering, and they increased their target range. And then when they priced out last night, they priced it $25. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And then I had the stock ticker up, and it just went crazy. I had absolutely no idea. It was totally beyond my wildest dreams.
And I guess full disclosure before we go any further, you didn't fork out any cash, did you?
I did not. Yep. I might be able to retire now if I had gotten ahead of the curve.
Why do you think investors were so keen to sink their teeth into Beyond Meat?
Well, I think the potential upside for Beyond Meat is just enormous. I mean, their sales continue to grow and grow year over year. They're basically only limited by their ability to scale up their production. So getting in on the ground floor of what could be potentially be an absolutely ginormous, just an enormous global food company, that's very attractive to investors.
What is Beyond Meat's plan?
Well, I think Beyond Meat's plan is just really simple. And first of all, they need to expand production to meet the growing demand for their products. And then they just want to continue to introduce new products and improve on the products they already have.
I've just watched an interview with the chief executive of Beyond Meat, Ethan Brown. He told CNBC that the company really isn't focused on the plant-based meat sector as much as it's focused on the meat sector itself. Now, if you were a cattle producer, a traditional meat producer, what would you read into that comment?
Yeah, I think that this is just another way of saying that Beyond Meat wants to make products that everyone loves and everyone wants to eat. I mean, they aren't simply targeting people who are going out of their way to look for a plant-based product. And they want to sell to everyone. This is why Beyond sells in the meat aisle of grocery stores and not just the meat alternative section of natural food stores.
A few of the cattle producer forums that I've been to this year in Australia, the topic of what gets called fake meat, it always comes up. In Australia, I know cattle producers have been told not to worry and that there will be room in the market for traditional and alternative meat products. What do you think?
I think that there will be for as long as I can imagine. And right now, plant-based meat is less than 1% of the market. So even growing at the rate that Beyond Meat is growing and other plant-based meats are growing, and it takes quite a while to get further up in the percentage of the market. So I don't think that companies like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods are the boogeyman. I just think that it's part of the overall change and evolution of agriculture.
That was Matt Ball from the Good Food Institute, which is a not-for-profit organization based in the US, which does promote plant-based and cell-based meat replicas. So, yeah, I guess, it does sound like it would have been good to get in before that. That is a pretty big IPO launch there at $65.75 a pop to have that company now valued at $3.8 billion. We've had a text in from Peter from Boolaroo. The only thing that's green this week is the envy that he feels for those lucky enough to have had more rain than the 7 mils that he's had. If you've got some rain in the southeast or perhaps elsewhere, you thought you'd missed out and then you managed to jag some last night or something like that, we'd love to hear from you. 0467922783. Also, really got our fingers crossed for the next system that hopefully comes through to get to those areas that didn't quite get rain this time around. But we'll head to the area that did get some rain. Local producers around the Eyre Peninsula will soon be showcased in the National Wine Centre following a recent long lunch. The long lunch held in Streaky Bay was so successful that the Wine Centre is keen to use more EP produce on the menu, as well as promote the region as a tourist destination. Trudy McGowan is the Vice President of Streaky Bay Tourism Promotions and says it's great to see what was a small idea turn into such a fantastic event.
Yeah, we've had a really good response with the National Wine Centre, who obviously prepared the food and also chose the wines and beers and were there for the 3 days preparing and then serving on the day. They were blown away with the local produce. They just thought it was so impressive. And they're looking at stocking and using in their menus the Saltiere Gourmet Sea Salt product that is over here, Haystack Honey, which was used in the dessert. And I know that they're keen to pursue both the Peter Tickle wines and the Beer Garden Brewery. So it's really impressive that not only using it as a tourist event, but also to be able to use it from a economic development point of view and showcase our produce and get that out broader area, across South Australia.
So how important is it to have that opportunity for small businesses to then promote themselves locally but then have it promoted on a statewide level? Do you think that'll bring more people to Streaky Bay as well?
Definitely, because if you think of the National Wine Centre, the fact that they're willing to incorporate those different products into their menus and when they do that, they talk about the different products. They now can talk about where it came from, the experience. They've met the people who actually produced the product. Gerald Cash was there talking about his honey at the lunch. All of those types of things give them a forum to talk and obviously let people know. And as we know, so many tourists and people want to go and experience where the product came from. So putting it out in Adelaide means that hopefully it'll increase a lot of people coming over to experience those products.
And you're looking at being a part of Tasting Australia next year?
Yeah, that's the plan. We think that we will have to move the date, but we think it's worth it. We've got 12 months to let people know because Tasting Australia is such a big event and gives us such a big audience to promote Streaky Bay. So we think that it's very important to be part of that. So we're looking at doing that. And we're also looking at doing it in a constructive way where we can make sure we create a few days of events. We know that already Coffin Bay have a great event during Tasting Australia. Where does Streaky Bay sit with that? Could we do something the next day or the day before? And also maybe look at what Ceduna can do. So we could actually create a bit of a trail that gives people another reason to stay a few more days on the Eyre Peninsula.
Trudy McGowan, Vice President of Streaky Bay Tourism Promotions. Jason Bird is the General Manager of the National Wine Centre of Australia. He says this was the first time being involved in a regional event, but it certainly won't be the last.
We're really looking forward to working with the abalone fishermen that we've met, or divers, I should say. The razor fish, there's somebody who now has a commercial licence for razor fish, and they are delicious. And we'll be featuring them on our Cellar Reserve wine menu later this month. because our chef's absolutely fallen in love with them. So there's definitely going to be some ongoing effect in terms of just us, but also us being able to shout the message that just how good the produce is. It is amazing. It's very rare to see a chef of Steve's experience, Stephen Clark's our executive chef, it's very rare to see him so excited about working with produce. He was absolutely stunned by the quality of what he was able to work with. So, yeah, there's definitely some flow and effect.
Do you think by having these smaller business products showcased in Adelaide will help to promote Streaky Bay as a region and also the Eyre Peninsula as a region, I guess, too?
Yeah, I think so. Look, the food and wine tourism, or the experiential tourism market, is huge. It's a massive focus for us in terms of our own business. And I think Lynn and Trudy and the guys at Streaky Bay Tourism are very much aware of this. And having a reputation for being a region that produces fantastic seafood, fantastic beef, fantastic lamb, amazing grains. The wines that we serve from Peter Teagle, Boston Bay, all these guys, are great wines, really technically good wines. So that just drives demand for tourism. But you do have to, it's a noisy world, and you have to find interesting ways, I think, to promote and to let people know. So us being able to get on board and help with that message is important to us because we've had a great experience, but I think it'll deliver some, incremental benefit to Streaky Bay as a region and to the West Coast as a region.
Yeah, there's great produce there. That was Jason Bird, General Manager of the National Wine Centre for Australia, speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. And we've been hearing quite a bit about how this lack of rain has impacted on grain and livestock farmers and as people start seeding. But another sector that's hoping for good autumn rainfall is the beekeeping industry. Honey producers around South Australia have been reporting, and we've been talking about this, a pretty dismal season with production down by about 70% in some parts of the state. Beekeeper Michael Pitt, who sits on the Executive Council of South Australia's Apiarist Association, says rainfall is needed to boost bee numbers for pollination services as well.
It's like any agriculture. It certainly does come in cycles. So you'll get droughts and then you'll get wet seasons. And quite often, if we have a wet season, it's not necessarily a good one for us. But quite often, a season after a big wet can be better. You get more flight time days, and everything's had a good drink. And so therefore, you'll get a good season. So yes, it's not unusual to have ups and downs, but last year was only sort of average, and this year was well below average, and it still hasn't really rained properly yet either across the areas that we need it. So it depends on how long it goes. It just depends how usual it is, but it's not unusual to have one season come through as particularly worse than the rest.
What will the effect be if the season doesn't pick up and this drop in production continues for longer?
The biggest flow-on effect at this stage will actually be not so much the production flow-on effect, but it's more the fact that it's going to be hard for beekeepers involved in pollination to get their bee numbers to an adequate strength to pollinate our food crop. So kicked off by the almond season, if we don't start getting some good rain to keep our bees going through winter, it just makes it really hard to keep bee numbers up to be able to have good strength hives to be able to do jobs like pollinating other food crops, and then that starts to get a bigger flow-on effect through for the state. And obviously, if we don't get good bees on the almonds, well, then that's when we start to get our honey after that. And if we sort of haven't got good bees then, well, then we start sort of struggling for honey as well. So, yeah, it can be quite a big effect felt quite widely in the agricultural industry.
There are a lot of eyes on the weather at the moment, hoping for more autumn rainfall to get crops going. But what would be, I guess, the best forecast for the bee industry at this stage?
I think it would be the same as any other agricultural industry out there. Would be a good general rain across the state. I think yesterday and today we've had some pretty good readings in our gauge down at Mount Compass, but you don't have to go too far and they drop right off to ones and 2 millimetres, which isn't really enough to kick things off.
are certainly where we want to take our bees for winter. It's quite sandy country, and it's nowhere near enough for us to get our bees out into that country. The tracks are still bone dry and very fluffy, and we just can't get bees out there. We're going to need a good general rain across the agricultural area to be able to get bees out into that country.
Mount Compass beekeeper Michael Pitt, he's on the executive council of SA's Apiarist Association, and they obviously represent both the commercial and hobby beekeepers as well. And you can read that story online at abc.net.au/rural. Finally, today seeding ramps up with this rain. I just got a message from Chris saying 2 mils at his farm at Narracourt in the last month. That doesn't sound terribly crash hot. I hope you jag a bit more rain in this system that's coming across, Chris, and anyone else who's really looking for it down there. But for people who are getting stuck in, croppers are being urged to tackle snail populations now before they start digging into new growth. Increasing numbers of snails have been spotted throughout the southeast of South Australia and Western Victoria, but a Narracourt based agronomist says the growing numbers are a nationwide problem. Senior agronomist with Western Ag, Andrew Heinrich, says baiting before the snails start mating is the key to stopping their spread.
And it's important that we get the baiting done now or as soon as they're actively grazing, because we need to get control of the adults before they lay eggs. Now, we've already noticed that the small conicals and the round snails are pairing up and mating, so that they've exchanged sperm, so they'll be ready to lay eggs as soon as they get some green feed to build up their energy reserves and reach a critical level that they require to lay eggs. So we need to control them before they lay eggs, because this year's egg lay is next year's problem.
Why are the numbers higher than usual at the moment?
It's just one of those things that, unfortunately, that snails are an increasing problem that we're experiencing right across Australia. From my experience in Esperance and West Australia, they were growing quite rapidly and expanding the area. And I think it's a common thing right across Australia.
Andrew, you have moved to Narracourt in South Australia from Esperance in Western Australia not too long ago, and you're seeing the same issue.
Absolutely, yep. And the same species of snails, predominantly the small conical snails and the round snails, the white Italians, are the most common. And there are a couple other species, but they're not as widely seen.
What is happening then if this is happening across Australia?
It's Mother Nature filling in a gap. She doesn't like having a gap in the environment, so any organism will take advantage of that opportunity to fill the gap where competition's been taken out for one reason or another. And by the very nature of farming, we're changing the environment and open up opportunities for bugs, grubs and diseases, and snails are no different. They're moving in, and as we eliminate other problems, whether it be insects or something like that, we open up the opportunity for something else to come along, and as I say, snails are just taking advantage of that opportunity.
At this time of year, most croppers are just getting their seeds into the ground. What effect will the snails have when the crops are new and sprouting?
That's the most devastating stage for the crop production is at emergence, because the crops are only small, particularly broadleaf crops and mainly canola, because the snail can simply chew off the emerging cotyledons and damage the growing point. You can create large bare areas very quickly, and slugs will do the same thing. Slugs and snails are in the same boat. And they'll do the same in pastures. They'll eat the small emerging plants and reduce your plant establishment, which is critical for good production in pastures. So, controlling the snails early in the season is critical to keep the numbers down for later in the season at harvest time.
How can you control them early in the season?
There's not a lot of options. They used to be described as 3 Bs, Basham, Batham, Burnham. But now I would add another one is Berrium. So depending on what your opportunities are and timing and all that sort of thing, if you can bash the stubble down, get it down on the ground, which is predominantly more of a summertime operation to use the heat of summer to kill the snails. So that one is not available now. Burning stubbles or trash on the ground is getting limited now because we're getting close to winter. But if you have a lot of trash on the surface that you can burn, that would eliminate a reasonable number of snails. And then, obviously, if you're cultivating, you will bury some of the snails. It won't be a complete control. But if they're buried any more than 50 mils under the surface, they can't dig their way out, whereas slugs can. And then, obviously, we then rely on baiting to control the snails. And we need to be ensuring that we're getting effective use of our baits, that we're getting them out at the time when the snails are actually actively grazing. Just because they're moving around doesn't mean they're going to go to a bait and graze on the bait and take a lethal dose. We need to be sure that they're actually going to take the bait and kill them. So what I suggest people do is actually put out some areas, small area, a couple square metres of hand bait, an area where they know there's some snails, and actually go back and check them on a regular basis to see that the snails are going to the bait and consuming it and dying.
Yeah, snails, the last thing you need in a dry season. That was Naracoorte-based agronomist Andrew Heinrich speaking with Leonie Thorne. That's all we have time for in the Country Hour today. Go online to abc.net.au/rural for more rural news. But keep listening to the ABC as it's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.